I'm Joy Manning, editor of Edible Philly. Welcome to Local Mouthful. We're here to talk shop with obsessed home cooks everywhere. Marisa is on maternity leave, so today I'm with guest host Rich Landau and Kate Jacoby, owners and chefs of several amazing plant-based restaurants, including the Groundbreaking Veg here in Philly. Thanks for joining me, Rich and Kate.
Thanks so much for having us.
It's great to be here. Thanks.
This week, we're talking about Dan Dan Noodles, Rich's recipe from the V Street Cookbook, what vegan chefs cook at home, and how to make a plant-based diet stick. But first, let's talk about something we read this week. I shared an article from Newsweek with you both about World Vegan Day, which was last week on November 1st. I didn't know World Vegan Day was a thing, but I thought it was a pretty interesting look at the way vegan diets have evolved and the way they've sort of become more mainstream. Did either of you have a moment to take a look?
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating that there is such a tension right now and that there's even a World Vegan Day. We've been hearing about it now for a couple of years, and it's celebrated here in Philly, which is super cool. And yeah, it's just a pinch me moment for us because we've been doing this a long time, and to think that it's become so mainstream and so accepted and celebrated, it's just sort of a marker for us about how far things have come.
That was, to me, the main takeaway. I couldn't believe it. The article reported that 25% of millennials are vegetarian or vegan.
That's crazy.
That's a big increase over past generations.
It's a massive increase. You know, and I think the key to the success of this vegan movement is the fact that veganism isn't an absolute anymore. You know, if you go back a decade ago, you were either vegan or you're not. And it just, you know, you couldn't really call yourself a vegan. I can't really legitimately call myself a vegan. I'm about 99% there on my best days. But, you know, these days it's whatever you want to do with it. You could be vegan on a Monday. You could be vegan for a week. You could be vegan for a meal. It doesn't matter. It's more a state of mind. It's how you approach what you're doing with your food and with your lifestyle. And I think that's really helped people to associate with it.
Yeah.
I think it just makes it more accessible. So to your point, like whoever did that poll, right, they're asking, and enough people sort of lean that direction, enough of their, you know, lifestyle that they can identify that way. They feel comfortable identifying that way. It's pretty cool.
Right. I was also interested, you obviously your business is vegan. And one of the more interesting points I thought was that the retail sales of plant-based foods have increased 11% just last year. And now it's a $4.5 billion industry. And the plant-based meat category alone is now worth more than $800 million.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, a lot of this comes down to the Impossible and Beyond Burger movement. These guys have dumped tons of money into advertising. Now, you know, if you watch a football game nowadays, you will see ads for the Impossible Whopper on there.
That's amazing.
And they're getting it out there to the mainstream, and they're doing it so convincingly well. They don't have a bunch of hippies running through a daisy field saying, you know, let's get back to nature. They're saying, you want real food? You want real flavor? You really don't need to eat meat to get that. And people are exploring.
I know the restaurant business is really tough, but do you feel like these trends have made it easier to run a vegan business than it was maybe 20 years ago?
I could take that, Rich.
Yeah, go for it.
I do a lot of, you know, time at the front of house, so I talk to a lot of our guests, and I feel like it's such a, I don't know, people accept it and embrace it so much more, whereas, you know, even 6 years ago, I'll say 6 years ago, it was a little bit of like a joke to people. People like to make fun, or they were uncomfortable. You know, there was always sort of like, I'm here to check it out, but, you know, I'm not vegan, or like, I'm going to get a cheesesteak afterwards. You know? Nowadays, I feel like people don't really think of it as such an alternative or something so different. It's part of almost their everyday lifestyle. Like, I think a lot of people have some kind of plant milk in their fridge at home. And that, you know, does that mean that they're vegan or not? But I guess it's just this idea that it's become so mainstream. You know, you hear it on television shows, you hear it all the time, and it's not such a curiosity anymore. It's just kind of something that many people do.
Yeah, I was going to say 15 years ago, it was really hard to convey our message. We were super, super careful about all the language we used, how we label things. Of course, there's no quotation marks with the words chicken with the, you know, without the E at the end. So there's no mock this, mock that. We never use the word vegan. because it was so misunderstood back then. And there was all these preconceived notions about what a vegan was and what a vegan diet was. Nowadays, it's so much easier. The Beyond Burger and Impossible Burger movement, and I call it that, but it's everything. It's Gardein. It's all these, you know, mock meats that have convincingly impressed people that, you know, it's really just the flavor, you know, and they can get the texture. It's made it so much easier for us because now they're all eating vegan bacon cheeseburgers. And they can also say, hey, well, what do you want to do for a date night? We can actually dress up and have a fine dining meal in a restaurant. That has made it so much easier for us because we're not constantly explaining ourselves.
Yeah.
And trying to get our message across. People know it before they even come in.
Well, we'll share the link to this article in the show notes for today's episode. I think that you all might find it interesting and inspiring as well. You know, I'm always happy to hear about it, not just because I like having plant-based options, but because it's an environmental issue, I think. And that makes me feel slightly optimistic, you know, in a pretty non-optimistic time with the environmental risk on that front.
Oh, I was going to say also on a personal health level, you know, for me, this was an ethical issue. It started all as an ethical issue. I just didn't want to eat animals. I love the taste of eating animals. I still miss it every day. But I thought it was ethically wrong to do what we were doing, especially because we don't need to. We will not die if we go vegan. We will actually, you know, the evidence suggests the opposite will happen. So, you know, that was all about it. You know, it's about ethics for me in the beginning.
Right.
But then it became about the environment. And nowadays it's becoming about personal health. People are realizing, you know, there's people that don't care about the animals. There's people that don't care about the environment, but they care about what they see when they look in the mirror and they care about what the doctor told them at their last visit. And, you know, this is a home run when it comes down to that, because they will at least care about themselves.
Well, I'm really curious what you and, Kate and Rich have for dinner, what you cook for dinner at home on your day off. The food, not all of our listeners are in the Philadelphia area, but the food at your restaurants is very thoughtful, can be have multiple components. It can be a little, even though it's vegan, it can still be very rich and indulgent tasting. And I just imagine that what you eat at home is not the same.
Well, you know, I hate to be so cliche about this, but we really do like simple food at home. We have we're not doing anything groundbreaking or not experimenting for the restaurant. We have an 11-year-old son, and we want to make something that we can all enjoy. We do things as simple as spaghetti some nights. You know, granted, we'll do a few bells and whistles, put out like a little vegetable antipasto first and, you know, do a fancy garlic bread and all that.
Being totally modest. He goes all out. It might be like seemingly simple for him. It is fast, but literally he'll put out like 8 plates for the 3 of us. And it's like all different things. And he does it in 5 minutes. It's crazy.
What does spaghetti night look like?
Oh, boy.
Kate. The last one, he's kind of talking about it. It was about a week ago. And he did do pasta, but then he also made garlic bread, which, you know, it was like with fresh garlic and it was beautiful. So that's indulgent. I love that. Okay. So he blanches broccoli rabe and then sautés it with garlic and then lemon. So it's like, that's a multi-step process right there. But I think the funny thing for Rich is that like, he just goes through it so quickly and he thinks it's no big deal, but yeah, it's pretty great. There'll be roasted peppers. Oh, he did this thing with artichokes and shishito peppers. That was like a little side dish. No big deal, right? I loved it. I'm very spoiled. And I do dishes.
Does the 11-year-old enjoy all this as well?
Oh, he loves it. Yeah, sure. I mean,
not a picky eater.
Oh, he's going through a stage where I think he's, you know, narrowing down what he really loves. You know, you love those one-hit wonders when you're that age. The things that, you know, the mac and cheese and the pizza stage were just a, you know, kind of like makes your brain, all your endorphins just kind of come out when you eat those one hit wonders. But you know, we never gave him a kid's menu when he was a kid. We made him always eat off of our plate, but the kids hit a certain age when they actually realize what they're eating. You know, they won't just eat anything their parents give you. And then they hear about stuff in school and they see this and that. So, you know, he's a vegetarian and, he's a pretty good eater, but, he's not wide open to anything. You got to twist his arm a bit.
He has a short list of things he doesn't like, so we know to avoid those, which include mushrooms and cucumbers and tomatoes. And then basically, oddly enough, he doesn't like tofu except for one tofu dish that Rich makes at Veg. That's the grilled tofu. He loves that. All of the tofu.
Who doesn't? That dish is incredible.
I love it too.
But Rich, can you tell me some other simple things that you make or as simple as they get for you?
Well, I love to cook Sichuan Chinese. That is my passion right now. We just actually booked our spring trip to Chengdu, China. So I'm going to hopefully get some more inspiration there and, you know, kind of fine tune this passion a little bit more. But I just love the flavors. They've really made everyone, you know, any great restaurant city that has Sichuan cooking, they're all rethinking what Chinese food is. You know, when we were all growing up, Chinese food was just a bunch of starch, sugar and salt. Mm-hmm. And we wonder why it tastes so good, because we're eating dessert and then we're hungry half an hour later because we went through that quick burn. Sichuan cooking is so much deeper than that. And just to be able to cook it plant-based, you know, and braise the tofu with all the chilies and the Sichuan peppercorns. There's so many layers to this food. So I love cooking that at home for Chinese night. And I guess my latest passion is Indian food. Ordering Indian food is usually our comfort place. You know, if we're home from traveling or a hard night at work, we'll order Indian food. And just so many times it comes in, it's like got a huge layer of oil on it. And you can tell it's been sitting in the steam table all night, maybe even from the night before. There's some great Indian restaurants out there, but there's some that just we've been burned by them. So I said, you know what, the hell with this. I'm going to cook it myself. And last year for the holidays, Kate bought me this beautiful like spice kit. So I've been exploring on building all my own curries with the spices. No curry powder allowed, just kind of creating my own curry powders. And, you know, each night we'll do usually chana masala, an aloo gobi. And usually a bonus dish, either like a lentil mulligatawny soup. But lately I've been doing tofu paneer with a spinach saag sauce around it.
I'm going to make that tomorrow. I'm going to mash up a recipe from Indianish. And she uses actually feta instead of paneer, but I'm going to substitute tofu.
Nice. So we will be
great
over
great minds think
30.
Alike. Well, I wanted to tell you both about something that I did in my kitchen last night, which was long overdue. I made your recipe for Dan Dan noodles, which is one of my favorite dishes at V Street. It's been on the menu kind of a long time, and it has some Sichuan inspiration, wouldn't you say, Rich?
Oh, absolutely. Dan Dan is not only a Sichuan classic, it's an original street food. You know, back in the day, I mean, centuries ago, I guess in China, that you know, this guy used to walk around with a stick across his back. On one side of the stick, he'd have some boiling broth. And the other side of the stick, he'd have a bucket with noodles. And people would hold out their bowl. He'd put the noodles in the bowl and put a ladle full of broth on top. And he walked to the next person. So it's the original street food. And it has been on the V Street menu since we opened.
Well, it was a lot easier to make than I was expecting. Basically, I don't know, it's probably been a while since you looked at the recipe in the cookbook, but you make a sauce based on tahini, sriracha, tamari, broth, chili oil, a little sugar. Let me know if I'm, maybe white pepper.
Sure. Yeah. Now, all those ingredients, that's the simplified version because, you know, we worked with a big publisher for this
sure.
book. And you want to make sure the people like in Oklahoma City and, you know, Austin and, you know, somewhere in Idaho can get all these ingredients. There is a specific kind of pickled chili that we use, which you can get in our.
I wanted to ask you about that. I was in the Asian market at 11th and Washington, which is a you know, in our city, Philadelphia, it's one of our few big Asian markets. And Dan and I were like going up and down the aisles. Is this the pickled chili and oil? Is this the pickled chili and oil? So ultimately we didn't use it, but where I find it?
Well, it's in any of those Vietnamese markets. And it is, it basically says pickled chili. It's kind of a chunkier version of sambal. Mm-hmm. And that has it's really, really spicy, but it also has an amazing flavor to it. That really adds to the sauce, but it just makes it very hot. You got to be careful.
I love spicy things, and the sriracha did make it pretty hot. But I did, and also you roast mushrooms, and it's very delicious. Black vinegar and sesame oil marinade. I did use maitake mushrooms instead of shiitakes because that's what I had. Mm-hmm. It was very very tasty. But I had a couple of questions. One is I knew that the recipe was probably geared towards the home cook. And I know there's the typical raw tahini that you get at the store, like from, I think you also like the Soom brand, you know, it's what you would use to make hummus. But I also had a jar from the Asian supermarket from a past recipe that's a roasted tahini. And I went ahead and used that. Was that the right thing to do?
Sure. How'd it come out?
It was pretty good. But I mean, when you make it at the restaurant, what do you use?
We just use basic tahini.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a brand called Beirut tahini. Soom gotcha. Is great, by the way. Love Soom.
I do like that. That's what I usually use for my hummus. But I think I actually bought this for another Dan Dan recipe. So I thought maybe this is better.
Okay.
It was still very good.
Great company, great people. But for this particular recipe, the Beirut tahini, I feel works the best. Yeah.
And I could not find fresh ramen noodles. They were out of a lot of noodles at the store.
You can use any noodle. I mean, you can buy dry ramen noodles these days too. And they work just as well, I think.
I used just a plain fresh wheat noodle and it was good. I'm really looking forward to having leftovers for lunch later. So I thought it was really good. And I usually sort of dismiss white pepper. I don't usually use it or buy it. But I think you said like some compelling words about how different it is in the B Street book. So I was like, okay, I'm going to do what Rich says and buy the white pepper. I think it made a big difference.
It's huge. Yeah. I mean, pepper itself to me, the biggest crime against pepper has been putting it in a shaker on a table next to salt. Mm. Salt, you know, salt is used to create, enhance, and bring out flavor. Pepper is a seasoning. It doesn't bring anything out. It's a seasoning and it's fruity and it's delicious and it should be used. You know, I believe in whole peppercorns. You grind them up in your spice grinder or your blender to use them and you bring out all these flavors. But white pepper itself is just, it's such a unique seasoning. The fact that white pepper and black pepper share the name kind of really bothers me because they're nothing alike. Absolutely. They're absolutely nothing alike. And I think white pepper is crucial. We have tons of recipes where we actually use black and white pepper because it's such a different flavor.
Yeah. Well, I'll definitely make it again. I am going to keep trying to find those ramen noodles. But if you want to try this recipe yourself, check it out. It's in the V Street Cookbook, which is absolutely worth having if you're interested in having some super exciting, delicious, and not at all you know, basic vegan dinners, which I am. So I did want to talk to you. I sort of wanted to get both of your advice on maintaining a plant-based diet for the long term. This is a thing that I've really struggled to do, and it's really important that I do it because it's the only way I can keep my cholesterol down if I don't want to take drugs, which I don't want to take statins or I want to avoid it as long as I can.
Don't do drugs, Joy.
How long have you both been maintaining a plant-based diet for the most part?
We both went sort of vegetarian when we were about 16 years old. You know, we've kind of talked about it over the years, and I guess that's a point in one's life when you're starting to be, you know, much more independent. Maybe you have your first job and you're starting to think about, you know, your own timetable and your schedule. I guess we both arrived at it. It seems like that's an age for a lot of people. And then for me personally, when I got into college is when I sort of, you know, that first year it was eye-opening and I thought, well, I learned what veganism was and I thought, you know, I want to take this to the next level. Like Rich, it was ethical for me, but also, you know, I recognize the environmental impact and my dad, my whole life as a kid, I always heard about his heart health and that was a huge thing for me. I used to make bran muffins when I was like 10 years old with, you know, every single week I'd make bran muffins for him. I could do it with like one hand tied behind my back. So as I sort of peeled back the layers of what a vegan lifestyle would be for me, it was just like a no-brainer. Rich always says that he craves meat. He misses the taste of meat. I'm kind of the opposite. I did enjoy eating all kinds of things growing up, but when I walk down South Street and I smell all the cheesesteaks, I kind of have to like cover my nose. I don't miss it that way. So, you know, for me, it's sort of, just staying stimulated in this whole plant-based world. When it comes to, you know, a veggie burger or something, I can totally enjoy it. But I really love like the vegetables first. So I really love what we're doing at Veg. I love celebrating vegetables. But you know, you working with the best quality product you can find, trying to stay seasonal. And after that, I feel like there's so much variety in the plant world throughout the year, especially in our part of the country. It's I don't know. I feel like every day it's something, you know, new and different, and I never get bored. So,
yeah, I think there's a couple aspects to keeping the plant-based diet, sticking to it. Number one is, first of all, practice forgiveness. If you slip from it, it's fine. Just, you know, try to get back on. You don't have to go back to eating what you used to be eating if you had pizza one night. You just slipped and you just move on with it. I found, you know, I started, of course, with vegetarianism. When I was 16, the word vegan was unheard of. This is the 80s. There's no Impossible Burger. There's, you know, nothing convincing as a go-to substitute. And for a kid who loved the taste of meat but didn't want to eat animals, I had to get pretty creative pretty fast. So I was like the world's biggest vegetarian dairy and egg freak. I mean, I was, I thought I was like the healthiest, coolest guy. I'm vegetarian. I just ate cheese like there's no tomorrow. And yet
I have a cheese problem.
Oh yeah. It's brutal. I mean, it's a very, very, addictive thing. And there's no great substitute for it yet. They're getting close and much better than they were years ago, but there's no great substitute that it can easily take the place of cheese. So through my 20s, I was really, I put on a lot of weight. I was bloated. My skin was all like pale and, you know, scaly, and I just had no energy. So I decided to really cut the dairy out. And when I did, I realized that vegetarianism, I will go on record as saying, is maybe possibly one of the worst diets you could possibly be on, because it enables you to eat all sorts of dairy. And I think it's really terrible for you. So what happened was, once I put it out of my system, and it was hard too, because I really crave cheese all the time, everything changed, and it happened very fast. Number one, I stopped craving it. I just have no desire to eat dairy. And when I do put it back, like if I have a piece of pizza or something, or if I go try some artisanal local cheese somewhere, it drops you. I mean, you feel it right away. Once it's out of your system, it's an incredibly hard thing to put back. So that's a bit of a challenge. But in a way, it's good, because if you don't crave it and you know it's going to make you feel bad, you'll stay away from it. So the key is, get it out of your system. It takes about 10 days, maybe 2 weeks. Don't touch the stuff, and your system will clean itself out. And you'll realize that human beings as a species were never supposed to be eating it in the first place. Yes, we're hunters, we're fishers, but we were never... there's no species on the planet that was ever meant to consume milk, let alone from another animal, after it's done nursing. And so that helped me a lot to understand the psychology and the rhyme and reason behind consuming cheese. And that helped me move on to a vegan diet. And the other thing is, I think for people is, if you really want to stick with it, I tell anyone who is cannot be convinced of a vegan diet but wants to try it, day one, make yourself a bacon cheeseburger. Do a Beyond Burger with tempeh bacon and Follow Your Heart cheese on a really good soft white flour bun, and you will be a believer. And after that, I think the key is go for ethnic food. Go for some Chinese food. Go for some Indian food, some Indonesian, Japanese, whatever. But don't order any of the chicken or anything you would in there. Go all plant-based when you order ethnic food, because you're getting all the flavor and satisfaction. You don't need the flesh.
It's so true that cuisines around the world have a much healthier proportion of vegetables to animal foods than we do. It is possible to go to a Thai restaurant or a Szechuan restaurant, and it's not hard to do an all plant-based meal.
Right, because you're eating flavor. The protein, the animal protein, is an afterthought. The flavor and the history of the dish is what's first when it comes to that kind of cuisine.
When you say ethnic food, and we are thinking, it's really just a comparison to what, you know, like maybe, for example, Rich and I grew up with in the Philadelphia suburbs, of like traditional meals that were basically based on this 1950s kind of American, kind of a TV dinner, right? I mean, it was like meatloaf and mashed potatoes with peas.
Yes.
Or some sort of chicken with mashed potatoes and peas. So it was,
it was
kind of repetitive. I think Rich and I have joked a lot about growing up and having like chicken 10,000 different ways. But yeah, whether it, you know, if it's Southeast Asian or Eastern European or some kind of Caribbean food, I mean, a lot of this has really informed what we do at V Street. Mm-hmm. And it's really just about breaking that mold of that meat, starch, veg that we were used to growing up and embracing this whole variety. And it's like you said, it can be so flavorful that you really, you know, don't miss anything.
Before we leave this topic of your advice to me as I try to be a more committed plant-based eater, Kate, I wanted to talk to you specifically about treats because yeah. You are the pastry chef.
Yes.
You make some of the most delicious desserts, vegan or non-vegan, that I've ever had in my life. And I'm wondering if my husband and I, we love our treats. And I'm wondering if you have any advice in terms of where to look for recipes, vegan recipes for desserts, or tips on translating your current favorite cakes and cookies and whatnot to vegan versions. Do you have any tools or tips?
Yeah. When I first got started, my sort of initial mission was to figure out some real basics, sort of canvas type things, whether it was just a cake or just a custard or ice cream. Really, really simple, traditional basic things that I could then build flavors on top of. And, you know, so for those, it was all about the simplest flavors being in balance and also getting the texture right. And to do all that, it was really just like change as little about a recipe as possible. So creme brulee is a great example. Instead of using cream, I would use coconut milk. But then beyond that, it was, you know, sugar and vanilla. And then the last part being eggs, it was like, okay, well, what is going to achieve the result that the eggs are doing in this recipe? So in this one, it's sort of setting it up and binding it and also adding richness. So I worked with the simplest change I could. It was a combination I found of agar and cornstarch. And that did the trick. And, you know, so basically that was this idea of change as little about it as possible. I would have, I'd read some recipes and it would be like, you know, instead of eggs, use flax seeds, or, you know, instead of this, use banana or applesauce. And I'm thinking, no, that's like too different. You know, you have to be mindful of what you're changing about it. What is the point of it in the original mainstream recipe, and how is the flavor going to change for the better if you're going to make a substitution?
What do you think of the Bob's Red Mill egg replacer? Are you familiar with that?
I'm familiar with it. I haven't used it. When it comes to egg, you know, substituting an egg in a recipe, for me, it's either the richness that the yolk provides. So for that, I'll go to a different type of fat. If it's the binding properties, then I'll usually go to some kind of combo of baking powder and baking soda. Or if it's to get it to rise, I will also use the baking powder, baking soda. And I'm actually a really big fan of aquafaba. I'm a believer. That was pretty exciting. I think we've all in our kitchen got very excited. I tested it out and was very impressed.
Cool. Well, the next recipe I have flagged to try in the V Street book is the halva ice cream.
Oh, nice.
So I'm looking forward to that.
You got that tahini,
much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, tahini is the best. It's so rich and delicious.
Yeah.
Well, before we go, I wanted to do our What We're Loving segment. This is a segment where we tell listeners something that we just love. And Rich referred to something earlier that I'd like him to tell us some more about, which is your Indian spice kit. Rich, can you tell us a little more?
Yeah. So this is basically a big metal tin. And in the metal tin are all these little tiny tins all filled with different spices. There's whole cumin seed, there's dried ginger, there's dried fennel, there is an incredible red chili, dried red chili powder that is just absolutely amazing. It's so spicy that if you even put in a quarter teaspoon into a dish, you will feel it like crazy. Turmeric, of course, little black mustard seeds, coriander. It's just amazing because what you can do now is you can build your own curries. Also, when you cook your basmati rice, which, you know, in and of itself is an art form, if you ask me, I put in this little metal like tea container, and I fill it with cardamom pods and cloves and a piece of ginger. So you get to cook your aromatic rice as well. But I'm having so much fun with it because I get to, and this is the key about being your home cook, is that you can control what you're eating. When we order it, you know, you are at their mercy. You're going to eat as much oil as they want to put in there. I'm not a huge fan of steam table food. Number one, it has to be cooled properly when you remove it. It can't be in holding all night long. There's so many do's and don'ts about steam table food that you're really, it's a high risk food. So I like to know what I'm eating. I like to have control over what I'm eating. I like to make sure I manage how much oil goes into it. And I also still get to take a little, you know, I use Earth Balance vegan butter to stir that in last minute to give it that extra, the illusion that it's a little bit fattier than it really mm-hmm. is. But just playing with those flavors is so inspiring.
And this was a gift from Kate, you said?
Yeah. And yeah, or a suggestion box from Kate that she wants to eat her Indian food at home.
Kate, did you buy the box separate and then pick out the spices yourself, or did the spices
come? I sure
did.
Oh, I sure bought all of them. I even got this gigantic bag of curry leaves. I feel like it was like the size of a pillow. But the fragrance was beautiful. I mean, you could smell it before you even opened it. It was so potent.
What a great gift.
Yeah.
Well, thank you both so much for coming on Local Mouthful. I really appreciate having you with me today and giving me lots of inspiration and ideas as I pursue my own plant-based path.
Excellent.
Wonderful. Great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's it for today's episode of Local Mouthful. Our thanks go out to Dan Call for editing the show, to Saul Rosenbaum for designing our logo, and to Raina Rose for providing the music. And thank you for listening. If you like what you hear, make sure to subscribe via iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Please follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Local Mouthful. Sign up for our newsletter, catch up on past episodes, and check out our show notes at localmouthful.com. Until next time, happy eating.